Welcome to I See What You Mean, a podcast about how people get on the same page, or don't, or perhaps shouldn't. Today my guest is Bob Nunley. Bob's a federal consulting market colleague and COO of Oasis International Corp., a technology, cyber, and business management SDVOSB. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, hi. Thanks, Lou.
You're welcome. I'm looking forward to our conversation. Why don't you give us a short, give listeners the short bio so they know what I know about you.
Sure. Well, I'm easily the most blessed person you've ever met in your life. I flew fighters in the Air Force for an entire career, which was a lot of fun. I kind of summarized my career as half the time I was building new things and half the time I was fixing broken things. I think both of those opportunities gave me a chance to work with and for some of the most amazing and influential leaders actually in our country. Mm-hmm. It's really a blessing. Mm-hmm. I think I've had a pretty good opportunity to apply and adapt those lessons to the roles I've had as a vice president, as a chief operating officer, as a president or CEO of various companies.
Yeah.
Happy to be here, and thanks, Luke, for this opportunity.
You're very welcome. So you and I have worked together. I want listeners to know that. And we think similarly about some of these things. We have had conversations about this topic before. And I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to set it up this way. There's a situation I'm very intrigued by that I'm working on, which is when a leader, any leader, team lead, CEO, anywhere in between, is having a conversation with a team and has that feeling that we're on the same page. Meeting ends and they find out later that they weren't on the same page. It's common. It could happen in between you and your wife. It could happen between siblings. It just happens. We think we're on the same page. We find out we're not. You had a very interesting practice in the Air Force that you used to actually make sure that when a conversation ended, you and others were on the same page. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes. You know, I think one of the interesting things is we're all colored by, in some way, positive or negatively, I guess, about the experiences in our lives. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, as a career fighter pilot in the F-16, A-10, and some other airplanes, there is a standard in the mission briefing where we call it the contract. And that's where the flight lead, he or she, is briefing the rest of the team. And laying out for all of us our roles and responsibilities, his or her expectations for how we will protect the formation, how we'll handle emergencies, how we'll handle specific radio calls or issues or threats, or if things pop up that we weren't expecting at all, how we'll deal with them, right? And so it starts at the first of the briefing, and it's normally stated up front. This is the contract. And we all nod, and we basically, it's almost like when you fly in the exit row of an airplane, mm-hmm. In this case, the flight lead looks at you and goes like, do you understand? And you go, yes, I got it. And I feel like I didn't fully appreciate the influence it had on me until I got into various leadership positions outside of the military. I'm very much interested in understanding that, yes, indeed, what I want us to do was properly and clearly communicated, that it was properly and fully understood. And now I get to see if that's true.
That's true. That's great. I want to unpack that a little bit. Called it a contract, which is very interesting. So it's like, you know, like the parties are signing something. They're signing on to something. They're agreeing to something. You covered some really important points, expectations, roles and responsibilities, some planned events. That's my label. I heard you say a few things that I could anticipate being in the mission, a planned activity or event, and then some contingencies, some what ifs.
Yes.
How much was this one way, you speaking to them? How conversational was it? How much did people have ideas that they chimed in with?
Well, I would say typically in the contract period, there wasn't a whole lot of discussion, but there was certainly clarifying questions.
Okay.
Or if somebody said, well, how about this other technique for doing this?
Right.
Yeah, those are always entertained, right? Because I think as we can almost always appreciate, We're not always the smartest people in the room,
right.
But you got to open that door to communication, right, to kind of get the great ideas
right.
coming.
Exactly. That's what I wondered. You've set the stage. Y'all take off, right? And there's how many of you? 3, 4, 5?
Well, anywhere from 2 to 45 or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes they're very large packages.
Yeah. Okay. And I think of a football team, American football team, breaking the huddle, right?
Right.
And going to the line of scrimmage. Each person knows what they're supposed to do. Each person knows what others are supposed to do to achieve an objective. No one knows what the defensive team will do until the ball snapped, right?
Right.
And then what I think is cool is, and then I'm going to ask you if it worked this way, the shared knowledge and the shared intent that the team had when they broke the huddle enables them to react to the defense to some degree to compensate for things that aren't going their way. If you're a guard and you need to open a hole to your left and the guy facing you moves to your right, he helped you out. If he moves right. into the space you're supposed to create a hole with, maybe your tackle helps you because he sees that, right? You can adjust.
Right.
Shared right. knowledge, shared intent enables people to not just execute their role, which is the starting place, that has to happen first, and not much good happens if people don't execute their role, but also to coordinate in helping each other as unforeseen and maybe unwanted events occur. Shared knowledge, shared intent leads to, I don't know, I think a higher probability of a mission accomplishment, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Right. We're mixing lots of analogies here, and I like it. I think you know I love analogies. But absolutely true. Right. As we would come out of the contract and then get deeper into the actual how we're going to execute the specifics of this mission or sortie, when we actually lined up and took off and pushed over into bad guy country and stuff like that, you never knew exactly what was going to happen.
Right.
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 And you had prepared for the worst. Right. And hoping for the best. But in general, you're absolutely right. The contract allowed us to know how we might flex together. Right. And so without getting into too many details, one of the reasons you fly in a formation, an even number formation typically of fighters, is because you can't check your own 6 o'clock. You can't look behind you, mm-hmm. not well. Mm-hmm. And so the wingman is flying line abreast with you, 6 to 12,000 feet, and he or she can see behind you and you can see behind them, right? And so when bad things happen, you're over there going like, okay, I know what my flight lead is going to do. I know right. what my responsibilities are, but I also know that I'm responsible for this piece of it. Wherever he or she turns, I've got to check and make sure the 6 o'clock is clear.
Right.
And so as you get thrown curves or the defense moves into the tackle's position, you go like, I still know what my job is.
Right.
I'm good to go.
Right. I love that. That's like a coordinated line of sight you described there, right? Where
yep.
you couldn't have your own line of sight, but someone else could. And then that leads to, like, someone could come call you and say and report something. There's sort of a shared, they're adding information for situational awareness, right? They're adding what they see that you can't see. That's pretty cool. Let me ask you, one of the basic questions I ponder and that I want the podcast to address is, what's it mean to be on the same page? What would you say, I think we've said it, but I want to be sure we didn't miss something. What did it mean to be on the same page when that mission brief ended and the contract was agreed to?
Yeah. So it basically meant that I know what my role is. I know what success looks like.
Yeah.
There's a great military piece here that I've been able to use in the civilian sector quite well, and that's called commander's intent. I knew what success was supposed to look like. I knew how it was supposed to be measured. And I knew my role, and as you alluded to, I pretty much knew everybody else's role, and my job's not to go do their job unless, God forbid, something happened and I needed to backfill them or fill in.
Right.
That's also part of the contract. If somebody doesn't make it to the fight or survive the fight, who's the next in line to take that person's job? That's part of the contract, right?
Yep.
And so I think that's stepping out to the jets or even now in the business world, us kicking off a project or a program or whatever it happens to be, is having that same shared understanding of, I know what success is supposed to look like. I know how we're going to measure it to know if we are being successful. I know what my role is in it. I know what my peers' role in it. I know what my boss's role is in it. And they know these things as well.
Right.
And so with that kind of alignment, I find that it's enjoyable even to get into the sticky pieces, and because nothing ever goes as planned, right?
Right.
Exactly as planned. That when you get thrown that curveball or the change happens, is knowing, okay, based on what I do know about our shared success, how do I attack this? What is my piece of attacking it? And then there's also the other thing that I think is critical in everyday operations, and certainly drilled into us in the pilot world, is no hesitancy to ask for help.
Interesting.
You know, fighter pilots yell out, "Mayday, mayday, mayday." It is not a sign of weakness. It is a sign of, I need help and I trust you. And I know you're going to be my help. Right. And so being able to have that confidence to ask for it, even when, you know, I know what the plan is, you know what the plan is. We got thrown a curveball, something's going badly. I could use some help. I think that's what also helps us get on the and stay on the same page.
I truer words were never spoken. And I think one of the things that happens in a situation in, let's say, just leave the military situation you've described, relationship, home, work, team situation, head nodding is often taken as a sign of agreement, inferred as a sign of understanding. In an environment where, for whatever reason, and we can talk about the reasons, although they're well documented, someone's not comfortable asking a question, it's very easy to leave a room with two or n number of people thinking some somewhat different things, maybe widely different things, but at least somewhat different assumptions, different understanding, different expectation, different prediction. You know, we're always making predictions of how something's going to go and why we're, and there's a really great part of the organizational management change literature about making an organization safe for those conversations, for questions, safe for honest conversation for questions. I did not know what you just told me about the fighter pilot culture, that you worded
that. Yeah, that you have to be comfortable asking for help, yelling mayday if you need to.
Not a sign of weakness.
Not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. It's a sign of strength because the culture is developed such that you don't think less of me. You know I'm calling for help because I trust you to help me. I have confidence in you.
That's really cool. Obviously, you don't. You know your job. You're not calling for help to say, "Hey, what was I supposed to do?" You're not. That's not what. You're calling for help because something has occurred. It could be mechanical, it could be visual, it could be, right? Something's occurred. And it also alerts others to something they might need to know about. I'm assuming, right?
No, it absolutely, right? Absolutely. Back to the visual lookout, right? When I'm flying line abreast with another fighter and somebody shoots a missile at us or something like that, I'm expecting that my wingman, who could be a much more junior officer or much less experienced, that he or she could yell, "Break right, break right." And I don't go as a leader, "Well, wait a minute, did you say right or left? Or like, why are you
coming
right?" Yeah, I am trusting that when they made that call to me, that directive call to me, and they know what the contract is and they know what success looks like, that they are being very directive to me in a way that I need to act now. I can sort it out in a little bit, right?
Right.
And that is a very different kind of cultural environment where you go, especially with the more junior staff, right?
Yeah.
Or the maybe the least experienced among us or whatever it is, giving them the right through a contract to be able to speak up and say,
"Yeah, that's true.
Hey, I'm seeing something you don't see."
That's true.
Right. I think there's another element of this culture, the fighter pilot culture, though, that's important, and I think it often is missing in business, as far as I've seen, and that is the debrief. After we fly the mission, and we come back, and we all walked out to the jets thinking that we were all on the same page, and we come back, The debrief is, as you've probably heard before, is a no holds barred, no rank in the room conversation about how well we did. And the youngest among us can call out the oldest among us or the most seasoned among us and say, hey, you said you were going to do this thing and you didn't do it that way. You did it this other way.
Yes.
And we may have this conversation. Well, I had to make a change on the fly. And the person goes like, well, you should have communicated that to me. Conversely, those people who were, you know, nodding like the little ducks in the room didn't do this thing. And I go, but you were nodding. And they're like going, yeah, we didn't understand. I go, okay, it's a timeout. How did we get that far down the path if you didn't understand, right? And so I think some of those experiences produce the scar tissue that goes like, I don't want to be in that position.
Yeah.
But it's that closing loop too that I think is important. It's not simply all the presentation done in the briefing, but the ability to come back after a mission or a program where you've delivered a project or a client engagement or whatever it happens to be,
right?
And have get that honest feedback for yourself and each other, right? And hold yourselves accountable to it.
Yes, the debrief as part of getting on the same page. That's really...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You've got to, in the same way, you know, we've joked about before that so many people think a communication, and man, I am dating myself here, but a communication is like a fax. You send it, so you must be done, right? Well, it's not done until you know that the fax was received and it was legible and that... they got it and they acted on it, right? Well, comms has to be the exact same thing, whether I'm trying to brief the business development team or a delivery team or, you know, a fighter pilot group is being able to come back and go like, so how come we didn't do this thing, right? We said we were going to do this thing, right? And we didn't, and start to uncover where the impediments were, right?
Yeah. I think each of us is largely on our own page. I've had folks disagree with me on this. Feel free to, but I think we have an own page that we're on. And to create it, to be on the same page, we have to create it. And we create it from our own pages. And to do that, we have to share something of what, and have to be heard, not just share, send, but be heard what something of that world looks like to that person. I always like to know why. Like, so if you told me what and why you saw something some way, I'd want to know. Tell me why. Not because I'm challenging you, because I'm really curious. And when I understand why you see something a certain way or why you size it up a certain way, I have a lot more understanding of what it means to you. And sure, that could be very valuable, because that what and why helps me understand how, or it helps me make decisions about how that's more aligned or more... Right, more aligned. So you mentioned commander's intent. We actually talked about it, but just say what that is, because it's a cool concept.
So again, drawing from military experience, commander's intent is a process or an approach used in the military that, again, I found very successful in its business application. It's where the commander or the leader, maybe it's a project manager or the CEO or the COO,
right,
or business development lead, whoever, states out the vision, the description, the definition of what the successful mission will look like. Not the details for how to do it,
right,
but what the success would look like. And then what winds up happening on the military side of the house is the people who will execute it then go fill in all those gaps.
Right.
Right. They go like, okay, so this is the vision of success. It typically also includes a statement of the why, right?
Right.
And then out of that, the captains, majors, lieutenants, everyone go and say, okay, well, here's how I would do that. What then happens is they do a brief back to the commander that says, okay, here's what your stated intent was,
mm-hmm,
and here's how we're going to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the commander can typically roll in and have a couple of conversations,
right,
about, well, why left and not right? Why fast? Why not slow? Why blue? Why not red? And all those kind of good things.
Right.
And then what winds up happening is, for the group of people that are involved in that, it starts to create a same sheet. We know, again, what shared success would look like. We know how we're going to measure that success. And then I know, and my boss now knows, what my role is in delivering that success. So it is an extension of what we started with, is the contract, right?
It is.
Commander's intent is indeed a way to do that, maybe at a broader or larger mission level.
And I think the shared understanding of what, why, and how, or the shared development of what, why, and how. You can be given a what and why. You go away and figure out some how and come back to talk to the lead, whoever gave you the intent. You might provide some information that causes them to reconsider something.
Sure.
When you start to work through the details of the how, it can inform some of the what and why, and adjustments could be made to keep that synced up. There's an element or characteristic of people working together that way we're talking about, which is emergent. We don't know everything at the beginning, and as we learn new things, we might reconsider something we thought at the outset.
And that's what we're seeing in agile software development today too, right?
Right.
And I lead a lot of agile software teams. And that's one of the things that makes me most excited about it is I know what the general vision for the software is, but until I get in there and start building it, I'm going to come across something that I didn't foresee. So the solutioning of the how happens in an agile environment where I'm not afraid to make a mistake. I'm not afraid to ask for help.
Yeah.
And then quickly iterate to do what we call fail smartly, fail fast, right?
Right.
And then move on to the best way to solve that, right?
Right.
So again, I see a lot of these similarities in how I was raised in the fighter world and what I'm seeing in the business world. And they're very much about the communication, the two-way communication, and the techniques to get everybody on the same page and knowing that we're not going to get it right, but how are we going to get back on the page?
Exactly. Knowing even that we might fall off the page or run into a ditch, but you got to get back on. And that's just part of the process. To me, getting on the same page has to do with, I have a definition I've been testing, is a good word, a definition I've been testing, that getting on the same page is agreeing enough right now to take the next step. So it allows for the iterations because you can come, right? You're just going to take the next step. And so you might be in a process that's somewhat linear and you could agree now about what the next step is. You take it together. You could have a conversation and you say, you know what, Bob, we're not agreeing on some basic things. Maybe we need to go do a little bit more discovery, a little bit more fact finding, a little bit more. We could agree to that. We go and collect some more evidence, some more information, some more whatever, bring it back, look at it together. But if we've agreed enough to take a next step, we're at least on that page. I didn't want getting on the same page to sound or to mean something ultimate or final or like the big C consensus. We're on the same. We have that happen in our lives, but especially in the work world, that's not how it works. That's not how projects go. That's not how initiatives. That's just not how the work happens. And so the ability to come back and I think I'm focused on discovery. What do we need to know? Appraisal. What do we make of what we know? And application. What are we going to do with what we know? And you can keep iterating those three things in cycles all the way through implementation, right?
Right.
Deep into implementation, you can be discovering new things, sizing them up, making sense of them, and saying, hey, we're okay, keep moving, or wait a minute, this came out of nowhere, a supply chain problem or a customer problem, and you make an adjustment. But what do you think?
No, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I think that that's very much how things operate today. The decision cycles have occur so quickly, and there's so many options and alternatives and so much data and stuff out there. It's kind of a fool's errand to go like, I think I've got the whole thing nutted. I got it. I understand everything from A to Z. It's not the case, right? Especially in anything that's competitive, because your competitors are trying to change and win too, which is going to cause you to have to act in a different way.
Right.
I know you're familiar with the OODA loop, right?
Yes, yes.
Which again, observe, orient, decide, act.
Yes.
Which is the microsecond flow of information that fighter pilots use, especially in air-to-air combat. Right, is observe what's happening, orient yourself to it, decide what you're going to do, and act, and do that 1,000 times in a second, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, the same thing, I think, happens as we're rolling out large business opportunities or we're pursuing, you know, complex IT solutions or really complicated client deliverables, right?
Right.
Is something's going to change. Clients' needs are going to change.
Yeah.
We laid out an entire proposal, and we're delivering this piece of work only to find out that the client actually wants something else.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are we going to do?
Right. Got to adjust.
That's right. Right. So taking that, and again, the concept within Agile, which is important in here, is the minimum viable product, the MVP.
Right.
I talk to people all the time that, I don't think Agile and those kinds of things are peculiar to the IT world. They're certainly applicable there, but to even writing something, right? A minimum viable product could be my first outline.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I go like, I kind of got that wrong. Right? Okay, great.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to swap sections around or things like that. Right.
Right. Well, we've talked a lot about what it means to be on the same page, how to get there, even how to stay there, with implications for if we fall off the same page, how do we get back on?
Yeah.
What do you do in a situation where you need to be on the same page with somebody, or team needs to be on the same page? It's not happening. You've attempted it, so maybe you're faced with the inability to get on the same page with somebody. What do you do? What are your options? What do you think at that point?
Yeah. Well, I think this is why leaders get paid the big bucks, right? Because whether they do or not, is you wind up doing a lot of introspective thinking about why this is the case or it isn't working, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you personally, I often start with myself and go like, okay, is it me?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there something I haven't been able to communicate here, right? And maybe I'm just, I find that there's this phenomenon in my own life where I have already thought through 10 steps and I'm, down the field a long ways. And the person's going like, wait, what sport are we playing? And I'm like, yeah, okay, great. Right. So I have to back up and do that. So I know that that's a personal weakness in my life. So I try to get to make sure we're all starting off in the same foot. But if I found that we've just taken a couple of swings and misses, one thing I often ask is, can the person, I might ask the person to tell me what they think we need to do.
Uh-huh.
Because I want to try to understand if maybe, just maybe, part of the impediment here is they've actually got a brilliant idea and I've squashed them and they're just trying to tell me what their brilliant idea is to pull this thing off, right?
I like that.
So I try to put them in my position and go, okay, so you tell me what we think, right? Another thing I often look at is, did I make a bad choice relative to the person's either commitment to this or their skill set? There's this interesting phenomenon too, and I'm sure you've seen it, where when you're working with a boss, right, and it's as opposed to say you're just working with your peer and that peer happens to be first among peers, right?
Yeah.
Versus you're working with your boss, is you don't want to let them know typically that you can't do something or you don't understand it and you may not ask questions.
Yeah.
Right. Because you don't want to come across. And this ties back to what we were talking about earlier.
Right.
My expectation is that if I've asked you to do something and you don't know how to do it, you're going to go like, I don't know how to do that. Right. But I also get that there's plenty of situations where they're just not going to say that.
Right.
They're not going to ask me that question.
Right.
So I'll try to dive into that. You do occasionally come up to a situation where literally this person is not the right one to pursue the task with you or to take that role or whatever it is. In which case, that's the hard conversation, right? Where you have to sit down and say, I just don't think this thing is for you. This is not in your strength.
They could be relieved to have.
Yeah, they could. They could. They could have been waiting for a chance to not have to have this conversation.
I like that. Is it me? I think it's always good to ask that question first because it's easy to overlook that question. It's easy to overlook that. Tell me what you think we should do. Answer that question, I think, could be very illuminating because somebody could have a different perspective on something that maybe if they're talking to me, I didn't have that perspective, or maybe I was aware of it but didn't think it through deeply.
Sure.
There's something I'm always wrestling with about what does something mean? Two people could look at the same thing and it can mean something different. I think that's pretty fascinating. And I think in the kinds of conversations we're talking about in the workplace, other relationships too, but the workplace team, what something means isn't always easy to communicate, and maybe isn't always, there's not space made for communicating that. Mm-hmm. And if I said to someone, tell me what you think we should be doing, chances are they're not going to just say back what you said. Right. What you thought.
Right, because then the conversation becomes, then why aren't we doing it, right?
They're going to say, well, then they're going to answer with something that might surprise me. It's like, wow, all right, yeah. Tell me more about that, because I hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, there's a couple of things that I've come across over the years that fascinate me. They continue to fascinate me, and that is how some people define terms differently.
Right.
So one of the things I try to do is, and I know it probably irritates some people who work with me, but I'll say, like, when I say this term or use this term, this is what I mean.
Right.
But there's another thing that I found useful in my life is and that's making creating a definition, if you will, for what a mistake is.
Right.
Right. And in my life, a mistake is a good intention gone bad.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so if we're not being successful, we're not on the same page of music, and it appears as though the other people are or the other person or whatever it happens to be is making mistakes. I use that as the thing. Was this a good intention? They had a good intention, but it went bad. And if by following that thought train, what allows me to do is say, like, okay, was there a communications issue? Was there a priority issue?
Right.
Was there a logistical issue that had it been solved, what they were trying to do would have turned out great.
Yeah.
Right. As opposed to, this was a bad intention that went well.
Right.
This was a good intention
that
didn't go well.
No.
And that's a mistake. And I take mistakes very personally if I'm in charge, right? Of going, like, how did I permit this mistake to happen with the team? Right.
Right.
Because they didn't have enough beans, blankets, or bullets, or notebook paper, or whatever it happened to be. Right.
Right.
Or I didn't prioritize for them well. So that's why this thing is late that I wanted to get done, because I didn't help them prioritize. Or back to where we were talking a few minutes ago, maybe it was a communication problem. Communication was mine. It was my problem.
Yeah. But you said something that made me think of enablers and constraints. I think a lot about enablers and constraints on people. And so you don't always know what constraints are operating on somebody, or constraints they perceive are operating on them. And some of the questions that you're asking, tell me what you think we should be doing, or you could even talk about the match between skill sets and a task, or between commitment and a task, you might find something surprising. They might share with you something that is situational and not personal.
Yeah. I would agree with that. And this becomes a really important part in the leadership role, right, is to be able to uncover those things that aren't readily evident, or might never be evident, and just begin to continue to be an impediment to somebody's success. You know, when you go through the hiring process, as most of us do, we're usually pretty good at it. Occasionally, there's like, oh my God, why did we hire Bob, right? But generally, we're pretty good at it. So my going in position typically is, no one wants to do something poorly or badly.
Right.
They're not mailing it in on purpose. There's something else out there.
Right.
And being able to understand that, they're a shared resource and they've got two other bosses and those people are squishing their heads to get something done. And so my thing's the third priority.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, and they're not going to rat out the other two bosses.
Right.
Right. And so how do I create that environment, right, where to be and stay on the same page, or if we're not on the same page and seeing the same success out of the commander's intent or whatever it happens to be, we're not seeing the successful vision of the contract, right, to be able to dive in there and create that rapport. That allows him to say, like, here's the problem. My dog's sick and it's really bad.
There's you probably know this in social psychology. There's something very well researched called the fundamental attribution error, and it means that we tend to ascribe more success to ourselves personally than situationally, and we tend to ascribe failures to others more personally than situationally, right? And it's a fundamental error, because in the research shows that, you know what, it's often pretty situational. We all know a person who didn't have their heart in something, or didn't belong in a role, bad fit. But those are the exceptions.
Yep.
Most people on a team are showing up every day to do a good job, and there's something about the system that they work in that could be in their way. And to pause, some of the questions you've shared with me that you ask yourself has the effect of pausing to check that. It's easy to blame the other person, but what's operating on them that I might not be aware of that could affect their performance? Mm-hmm. And if I'm aware of it, can I do something about it? Is obviously we're there. And like you said, it's maybe part of what it means to, maybe it's part of what's fundamental about being a leader, is that you search for those kinds of things.
Well, another absolute truth I have discovered after or during 35 years of senior leadership positions is that there is always more to the story, right? There is always more to the story. There's always a separate way to look at it or a piece of data that you didn't have as the boss, right?
Yeah.
We get insulated a lot of times, right? Because we're an inch deep in 1,000 things, trying to keep companies running and clients happy and all that kind of good stuff. And there's somebody who's working on this who's a mile deep in 3 things. Right?
Yeah, right.
And what's their perspective and what do they think? And, you know, I'm not always the smartest guy in the room. In fact, I probably am almost never the smartest guy in the room. But if I am smart, it'll be that there will be really smart people in the room and we'll all be on the same page and be listened to them, right?
I love that. It's a great axiom. There's always more to the story. You know, there's also this notion of bounded rationality, which is, we can only know so much about any situation, and we can only process so much about any situation. So our rationality about a situation is bounded. But the kind of communication you are talking about stretches those boundaries, right? It opens them up because you can add to what each other knows. And I like to think about that as creating more of a group knowledge out of individual experience. And that group knowledge is additive, but I think it's also multiplicative, right? Ideas start to come together and people have an aha moment. Oh, wait a minute. Right. If that's what's going on with the client and that's what's happening in the supply chain, what if we do this?
Right.
That emerges out of the conversation, and nobody had that on the agenda. Nobody had done a report on that. It just comes out of the conversation.
Right. Well, I think this ties well to Lou, to how you even began this whole conversation is, being on the same sheet of music or being on the same sheet is not for a singularly exclusive task. It's about how we operate together, right?
Yeah.
And so have we created that environment where leadership listens to everyone else and everyone else is listening to each other and everyone feels comfortable in that environment, you know, speaking up and speaking out and helping everybody create the dots. There's too much data, too many decisions to be made, too many options out there that any one of us knows at all. What I try to coach to the teams, all my teams, is none of us is as good as all of us together.
Right.
The question is, have I created an environment where it's truly all of us together?
Right, right. Where people can really bring their best to something and it's welcome. That also makes for a pretty exciting and gratifying environment to work in.
It certainly is for me when I see groups of folks self-organizing to solve a problem and being able to run after it. You know, they've tied strengths together and they've put strengths over weaknesses of individuals. They figured out how to do that. Oh man, it's an amazing thing to see.
You know, have you noticed how, like out of nowhere, how much energy can get created by people coming together that way? It comes from the interaction. It's like a physics thing, chemistry.
Yeah, absolutely. And you start to see that success. And that's another part in this whole leadership daily struggle is to, in those challenges where it's really hard for the team to get it in gear and get in sync and be aligned with the client and produce things, how can I as a leader introduce that modicum of success where now they can build on it, right? You talk to coaches who are, you know, or 0-6 teams and 0-7 teams. They just want that one little victory, right? And because they know with that they can build more energy and they can build, get people on the same page and all those kind of good things. And that's our mission, right? is to try to figure out how to get that to the team.
We can't stop without you sharing with me, which we discussed before, three roles or three responsibilities of a leader.
This is something I coach to, and it does very much tie to what we've been talking about, is when I hire somebody into a leadership role in the company, it doesn't matter whether they're a dock foreman or, you know, they're the senior vice president of something, is I tell them they have three commitments to the company, and that's to create the vision for their work area, to develop the culture of those around them, and to communicate the decisions, right? And just quickly, create the vision. Is that commander's intent? What does success look like for us in our group? Whether, you know, we're loading trucks, or we're selling products through BD, or we're running the entire company. What does success look like for our group, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then develop the culture is very much about creating the things we've been talking about. What are the decisions I can help us make? What are the skills I can develop in the team that'll let us all work as one big group, right? And it's all about creating the values, right?
Yeah,
what are the true, genuine values that we operate by? Because that's what drive operations, right? Those decisions we make. And the third part is communicating the decisions. It's not enough to be in a leadership role or a supervisory role and be able to decide yes or no or up or down or green or red, but to communicate that to the team, because that's what allows you to say, here's the decision I made, here's why I made it,
right,
and tie it directly to the values and to the vision. So it creates this nice tight circle for your team. And I believe that does represent the kinds of things you kicked this conversation off with, about being on the same sheet. We have a shared vision, we have a shared culture, and we have a shared understanding of how to make decisions.
Yeah, I love it. We've talked about that before. It's concise, but it packs a lot. I'll share a little notion of culture with you, and then we'll wrap up. I've been, I've done some organizational culture work for some time, and I always like to know what the scholars and practitioners are saying about these things, because they think about it more than I can, and I like to start with what they know. And the literature on organizational culture is abysmal at defining culture. Can't tell you how many articles or books I read that I never could have gotten past a graduate school professor of mine, because it says it doesn't define it. It says culture refers to, or culture is about, and it goes on for paragraphs or chapters, and it never really defines it. I would have had them slashed to ribbons if I had turned the paper that way. And so I hit on a definition some years ago that actually came from the business model. You know, there's a lot of work in about business models and the business model canvas you might be familiar with. And I adapted a definition from that for culture, which is organizational culture, which is a shared rationale for how we spend our time and our talent the way we do, and not in some other way. So the key element is it's a shared rationale. It's not something that I hold or something that you hold. We have the same rationale for why we do what we do in our jobs. That might be keeping our head down and not getting in trouble. That might be free to ask questions. It's a shared rationale for why we do what we do and not something else to get our jobs done. And if you look at it that way, you can see culture cut across different lines in the organization. Maybe there's in some organizations, there could be a culture of school nurses, because they all face a certain situation or similar, right? And they've got a shared rationale for why they do what they do and not something else. They could be in 200 locations across a county, but maybe there's a culture of it, right? There could be a shared culture. If you think of it that way, it can cut different ways. It could be really interesting, like lines of sight into an organization, and go, well, that makes sense. Now I see what's happening there.
Right. Now, I'd agree with you. My personal definition is pretty close to yours, and that is mine's a shared set of values that drive what we, how we decide and how we act.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Very, very similar. Yeah. And I liken this to when we were 16 years old and we were about to do something, a little bell went off in the back of our brains and we go like, gosh, what would my mom think? Culture to me is when that happens across an organization, in the absence of direct supervision, where I tell somebody to do something and they have to act. It is truly based on the values, not the ones we espouse, but the ones we actually have as an organization that will drive that decision. If we could talk about our corporate value as integrity, but if we pencil whip stuff or or we turn a blind eye to inappropriate behaviors or things like that,
yeah.
then the people who are making decisions on our behalf, absent direct supervision, are going to make choices that are aligned with what we're doing and not what we espouse.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right. And so that's why it's, you know, the second thing on my list is develop the culture.
Yeah.
It really means develop and execute the values within the, whether it's the loading dock or the front, the C-suite.
Yep.
That truly will allow those in the organization to be successful and to do the things we want them to do without our direct supervision. Right.
That's a great comma clause without direct. Yes. It's what happens when someone's not watching or someone's not looking or like you said, there's not, someone's not telling you what to do. That's the, when you have, when you act a certain way and not another way, and when others do the similar thing, you have a culture. It could be a bad culture.
Right. Absolutely.
But and you have a culture.
To your example there of disparate geographically dispersed units or organizations, absolutely the case. The parent organization could have this set of values, but if you go visit that outpost, they're operating in a totally different way, right? And you're wondering why they're not successful or something like that. And so it has to be, again, that bell going off in the back of your head going like, gosh, if my mom was here, what she think? Because, you know, the COO's not here, the CEO's not here, the VP's not here. What decision, the decisions I'm facing, what would they expect?
Bob, thank you for joining the podcast. I had fun and learned a lot, as I always do when I talk to you.
Well, you're very, very kind, Lou. Thanks for this opportunity, and always available to have a chat about stuff that's passionate and notable.
Thank you. I think this was, we had a very illuminating, a lot of great conversation. I think there's a lot of good things in there for people to try, which is what I like to do with the podcast. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you.
And that's how we see it, my friends. I want to thank Bob for recording today's episode. You can find it at iseewhatyoumean.castos.com, plus all the places that you usually listen to podcasts. Send questions and suggestions through the app. Subscribe and give me a 5-star rating, unless you can't, in which case, tell me why. And join me next week when we take another look at how to get on the same page and stay there, unless we shouldn't.